So this is, I'm going to be giving you a series of shiurs. This one tonight is going to be introduction to part three of God vs. the Multiverse. Okay, so that's the book that Rabbi Feder and I have been working on for it's a little over 7 years now. Okay?
7 years,
that's right. And 2 more years will be done. Okay.
Did you say that like 4 or 5 years ago? Yeah.
Correct, we're consistent, so always 2 more years. Okay. And part three is, it's the part about God. Okay, and it's essentially revolves around the ideas of Yichud Hashem and the consequences of that. Okay, so the text we're going to be working with is the part of the book, is the third part of the book. I sent you guys out the introduction to part three. Hopefully read some of that tonight. There's two purposes of these series of Shira. Okay, one is just for the Shira itself, the give and take with the guys, you know, going through Yisodei Hadas of Yichud Hashem, understanding these ideas, right? That's obviously a worthwhile endeavor. The book is, it's entirely based on science and philosophy. Okay, so the book has no religious sources in it at all. It's not based on revelation, anything like that. It's entirely working within a philosophical, scientific framework. Okay, it's possible that part three has 5 chapters total. As right now, I think that's what it's going to end up with. I don't think it's going to end up with more or less. 4 of them are mostly written. The 5th one's last one is kind of, you know, has to write itself. Okay. Well, hopefully by the time we get there, I anticipate this will take some time. I don't think this is going to be super quick. Okay. So one thing is just the value of going through this, going through these ideas. And the second thing is when we started this book, we didn't really start it as a book. We started as a blog about 7.5 years ago. And, it was on the bloggers here. Okay. And we started as a blog and, it was, we had a lot, there was a, you know, from the older generation, but you know, about 7.5 years ago, it was very helpful. We had about a good 10, 15 guys arguing it out back and forth, you know, asking us questions, them giving their own points and discussing it between themselves, you know, back in the days when blogs were all the rage. And it was very helpful for developing the ideas and getting them clear and really developing them. So my hope is in addition to all of us gaining just from the discussion itself, but the, you know, it's like when you go through this thing, it's writing a book, it's like hard to know exactly what problems people have, what won't be clear. You know, there could be logical problems with this, things that, you know, don't necessarily follow. So that's part of what, you know, I hope you guys can help, the give and take, and, you know, flesh out any problems that are in the book, in the conceptual order. You know, sometimes when you go through these things, you realize, like, I don't really know exactly what where we're going. You know, it's kind of what happened this chapter. The plan was to send out not just the introduction, but to send you guys the first chapter of part three, so that you would know exactly kind of like what kind of what we're talking about. But like as we're going through it, you know, it just ended up, I don't know what we're doing here. Started writing it, rewriting it, and you know, it's not really ready to be sent out.
Okay? Why start part three?
Why am I starting with part three? Okay, good question. Okay, parts 1 and 2 are okay. They're really entirely. Well, it's much more heavy in the science than parts 1 and 2. Like even the part three does have science a lot. It's decent. Obviously you can't really discuss God and without discussing science. You have to get into that. I really wanted to do it. So Yichud Hashem. It's a shame not to go through the Yisodei HaTorah. Yisodei HaTorah. The idea was not really. I don't really know. I'm not sure. We're going through part three. That's what we're doing. Okay. Good question. I hope you guys ask a lot of questions. The idea is to be a discussion. Okay. Probably the introductory shiur will be a little bit less of a discussion because I'm not really going to try to prove parts 1 and 2, go through it in like, in a rigorous manner. I haven't really seen part one for a couple of years. You know, so hopefully it comes out of fine. You know, more or less what I tell you.
We can rehash it out.
Parts one, you got to start from part one, you know. But I'm just going to try to do it based on memory, just a little bit, you know, the basic idea. We'll start. That's the main thing. I don't really know exactly. The idea really was, I just thought these ideas of Yichud Hashem, they're fundamental, and I think everybody would gain from them. And also, this is the part we're up to. That's the truth. This is the part we're writing right now. So, you know, it's a work in progress, okay? We've rewritten this. This is the fifth time we're going through the book, and we largely rewrite it each time. And we're in the midst of part three right now. So it kind of worked out that we're doing it. I don't know, 75% done with part three but we go over it each time. So like now we're in the midst of doing it. I thought it'd be a good idea to work through with the guys because we're working on it now. Yeah.
Are you giving this year purely from the text?
The text, I'm going to be basing it on the text. What do you mean? As opposed to...
Are you using other sources as well in this series this year?
There's a possibility. I'm not sure what I want to do now. It's possible that, like for example, the first chapter is basically, we're not quoting any Rambams in the Ronavucha, the Mishneh Torah, you know, any other Rishonim, anything like that. But the ideas are in the Rishonim. So it's possible, after I do the first chapter... We'll go through the Rambams and Yisodei Torah and the Mor Nevuchim that first chapter was based upon. Part of the problem is the Rambam is in a certain sense done this. The Rambam more so than other Rishonim. The problem with the Rambam is it's largely based on Aristotelian science. Okay, so in a certain sense, what part three is trying to do is to give a updated version of the Yisodei Torah, the first couple prakim, few prakim. And the Mor Nevuchim, where it's, you don't have to, it's not easy for a person to separate out which ideas of the Rambam are, still stand and which ideas fall. Because it's very hard, the Rambam's philosophy is intertwined with his physics. That hasn't changed. That your metaphysics and your ideas of certainly proving God and how God interacts with the world, that is... it's very much tied to your physics and your science. And you can't really, Rambam himself says that multiple places. And you can't separate the two in the sense you have to go through science. And when science has really gone through a major change from Aristotle to not just Newtonian physics, but modern physics of quantum mechanics and relativity, and these are major, major changes in the categories, not just in particulars, but the categories in which science operates. And it's very hard when you go through Mor Nevuchim, Mishneh Torah, to really separate out which parts of the mitzvah, which ideas stand, which ideas no longer can stand. So part of what I'm trying to do here is to really put the ideas in the Rambam in a modern context, using modern science. The book is going to be the basic text. And maybe I want to go through these. I'm not just going to read the book straight. Paragraph sections is broken up into sections. You'll see, the idea is to use the book as the text. But it'll be a lot of the discussions will be outside. See what bothers you guys. And you'll see as we get into it. The introduction might be a little bit I don't want to say boring, but it's an introduction. It's going to be less juicy than the actual chapters themselves. Okay. So any questions before we start? I mean, I'm going to start reading in the beginning, but right away it's going to be mostly outside. Tonight's going to be a little different.
So the Rambam, who had Aristotelian science, is lacking in his Das Hashem?
No, just his the way he did Yedias Hashem, the way he did his mitzvah was in his scientific framework. But we don't use that scientific framework anymore. So we have to use what's the knowledge that's available to us that we believe to be true. So it's just going to take a different form. And the proof the Rambam gives is, for example, the proof the Rambam gives in the Mishneh Torah and how he begins the Mor Nevuchim, the second book. I mean, it's based upon the premise that an object in motion needs a force to keep it in motion. But, with Galileo and Newton, that inertia, that an object motion will stay in motion. If there's no interference from an outside force, the whole proof goes bust. Okay, so where's your proof? How do you know God? So that's just the most obvious thing that stares a person in the face is the whole proof doesn't work anymore. I'm in the Mor Nevuchim book too. He starts with 26 premises. But a handful of them just aren't true. So
a person knows the Rambam cold today and he doesn't know modern physics.
Well, he's living in Aristotle. Doesn't make right. Doesn't make sense. Aristotle's not right.
Which audience are you trying to capture?
Who is the audience? Right now, you guys.
No, I mean the book.
For the book? I mean, the book.
Which audience? I just want to try to put myself in that framework. Like, okay. Yeshivish crowd, secular crowd.
Yeshivish crowd, no.
Modern Orthodox crowd.
Okay, so it's not necessarily. Specifically. It's not necessarily a Jewish audience. It's not written as a religious book. Okay, so there's nothing in religion about in this book. Okay, that's the first thing.
So we shouldn't be arguing for a religious statement. We should just be arguing for
right. There's no nothing from religion here. There's nothing. It's not relying on any type of revelation, any type of divine providence, anything like that. Okay, it's purely based upon philosophy and science.
Right.
Okay.
So you just want us to just have like it's going to be like natural, just the conversation or questions just come up.
Right,
where
right.
It bothers us.
Right, correct. Don't ask me a question from a pasuk thing. I mean, you could ask a question. That's interesting. It's an interesting thing. You could ask that question, but that's not what the book is. That's not what the book is. It's not trying to. It's not within the framework of prophecy and revelation, things like that.
So are you mainly trying to target the non-Jewish crowd?
No, we have two basic targets readers. One is the person who already the religious person, okay, who already believes that God exists because of the Torah or because of some other religion, be it Islam or Christianity, whatever it is, and they believe in God because of authority. Their parents have told them to, their teachers have told them to, and they believe it. And they could have other arguments besides just scientific philosophical arguments. But they're looking for a rational argument based upon science, based upon observations that you can ground their belief in. Okay, and that's like in the Torah we have Yedias Hashem, the mitzvah of Anochi. The way the Rambam formulates it is he gives an argument in the beginning of Mishnah Torah from science, right? How you know that God exists.
Right.
Okay, and also it's not just how you know God exists; it's also Yichud Hashem, right? What does it mean? What's our idea of God? Okay, and the different ideas of knowledge about God, and there's a bunch of chapters. The other one is somebody who's doesn't necessarily believe that God exists. The other reader is somebody who's open-minded, right, who just does. He's not sure. He's interested, and they want to know without assuming any prejudice or bias one way or the other, is what an honest investigation of the universe. What the conclusion can you draw from an honest investigation of the universe of whether the universe has a intelligent cause for its existence or something else? What is the ultimate foundation of reality? Now, look, honest, unbiased, unprejudiced people don't really exist in this world. Okay? So it's a theoretical reader.
Not, they don't exist in the world, but they exist at 737
on fire. Yeah, exactly. Right here. That's the reader, a theoretical reader. So it's written in that framework. If you're open-minded.
Anybody who thinks I was serious, it was a joke.
Well, I thought you were very serious.
Yeah.
You're biased.
So, we have no real, I don't think most people are moved by truth very much. I don't think that's, most people that's argue, rational arguments and philosophical arguments don't really move them in terms of very much at all. Okay.
So you're targeting a very small group of people.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of people who think they're these types of people, So yes, there's a small group in reality, but a lot of people think they are that way. So it's really a lot of people out there, okay? Who believe a lot of people believe they're open-minded, okay?
All right, that's good.
Yeah, so people believe they're open-minded. That's what we're targeting.
Okay.
No, yeah, I don't think we're gonna convince these atheistic scientists or really hardcore secular agnostics, whatever it is, that they're gonna. I don't think they're going to read this book and be moved. Uh-huh. Not necessarily because I think there's a logical problem with the book. I just don't think that logic and arguments really move people. Mm-hmm. Okay, but there are people who, who just want to know. There's that person exists.
Are you purposely not trying to target the Yeshivish audience, or is that just by coincidence?
I'm purposely not trying to target the Yeshivish audience because I don't think I don't know them that well, but there's a lot of science, and I just don't know how. I don't think they'd be very open minded to modern science. I think that the firm world has largely thinks the Big Bang is like they reject the Big Bang, right? That because it's 14 billion years and you have to, the Torah in a literal sense says the world is less than 6,000. So they don't like the Big Bang. To me, I think I don't understand. The Big Bang is the greatest evidence of creation, the Rishonim, what the Rishonim would have done for evidence of the Big Bang. But I just, but this book, I mean, it's weird. This book is accepting the scientific framework. It's accepting that the empirical evidence indicates that the Big Bang occurred. But I don't think religious people who take the Torah literally are willing to accept that. So that's why we're not targeting those people. You know, but I think modern Orthodox Jews in general are willing to accept science. Okay. So it's for modern Orthodox Jews also. But again, it's not a religious book, even though we do anticipate that a lot of the readers will be religious. But
so you just want us to be in the mindset of those groups of people?
Yeah, in the mindset of what can you know? Just what can you know based upon science and philosophy? Avraham Avinu. What could Avraham Avinu, if he lived now, wasn't based on any revelation, what could you have known about the cause of the universe?
What's been your favorite moment having written this book?
Right now. This moment. Okay. Okay. All
right, listen, good questions.
Right. Very good questions. Excellent. No, it's good. It's good questions.
Great
questions. Yeah, go ahead.
It presented the Rambam basis, his metaphysical proofs, largely off his physics. And he was able to, demonstrate that Hashem is real based on totally faulty premises.
Right.
And now we're going ahead and presumably attempting to do the same thing based on our physics with the perfect knowledge that it's very likely to change.
So, right.
So first of all, what are the odds that we're continuously able to prove a reality based on faulty premises? It just seems kind of like, I understand if you want to say something's true, then based on good premises, you're definitely able to prove it. But if you're continuously able to prove a certain result, which we all believe beforehand either way, because mostly Jews coming up with these proofs, or at least usually, well, it's not always in the old days, it wasn't. But if it continuously come up with the same result based on faulty premises, doesn't that suggest that there's something totally off with the...
Oh, right, maybe you're motivated to prove something, even if it's not a good proof, right? Something like that.
It suggests a strong
one
with all the
premises. Aristotelian science has been superseded, okay? But look, and our science will be superseded one day also. Our science definitely has its issues. For example, at its core, there's a contradiction between general relativity and quantum mechanics. Okay, and our formulation of quantum mechanics itself has major issues. But, ultimately, you have to work within the science of your times. And no science ever ultimately, in my opinion, is going to get to the ultimate truth. This is science. The science and the scientific categories are going to work within the best that's available to us in terms of understanding true reality. Now, true reality is not really, knowledge of that is not really attainable by a person, at least it seems. And you just got to approximate it. You build models of the world in order to approximate how the universe works. And, as you test your models out against reality, when you see that they fail, you see that when you, you see that an object in motion stays in motion, in outer space when there's no friction or anything like that. So you see you have to change, there's something wrong with it, your model, and it's contradicted by fact, and you have to update it. You have to build sometimes a qualitatively new model, sometimes you tweak it, okay? But, and in fact, it's you have to work within the knowledge of our times and the science of our times. What would science tell us about the cause of the universe? Okay, so look, it's true. It's dependent. If ultimately, gravity and quantum mechanics, all these things turn out to be wrong, completely wrong, then you'll have to see what the new framework that replaces it. In that framework, what's the you have to examine what's the cause of the universe in that framework. Okay,
you don't think there's a metaphysical proof of Yichud Hashem, which goes beyond any physics. Yeah, physical.
No, right, correct. I don't.
Really?
Yeah, right. I don't believe. You're referring to like an ontological proof of God.
Yeah.
Right, I don't believe in that. I don't hold by that.
What does that mean?
It's like basically, can you by pure logic alone without any observation? The question is like it's an a priori proof.
But pure logic alone.
Pure logic. Really, in my opinion, it means can you by word games prove God exists? That's what it really means. But some people believe just pure logic alone dictates that God must exist. But to me, whatever I've seen, it seems like a word game when people try to do that. I think that if you want to know that God exists, you must first observe the world and then study the universe and see from a study of the universe what emerges. What is the cause of the universe?
Uh-huh.
Okay? To say what the cause of the universe is.
So what
but like we can get into that. I mean, we'll can get into that.
That could be a subject of discussion.
What?
That could be a subject of discussion.
Yeah, I mean, the first chapter will probably get into something like that. We would definitely talk about that in the first chapter a little
bit. Yeah, I'm just imagining that living in a box, not saying the word, how it's
Yeah, right. And if he doesn't, I mean, also, do you know you exist? If you don't know anything exists, do you know you exist? Once you know you exist, maybe you can get somewhere.
I mean, the biggest proof is Avraham
Avinu,
you know.
Yeah, he looked at the world. Right? The Medrash about Avraham Avinu is he studied the world and he said, you know, can you have a castle without a...
Are we able to use that story? Because that is, in the Torah, I mean, is that something that we should be using?
You can use it. You can use any knowledge you have, so long as it doesn't rely on revelation. I mean,
is that revelation though?
What?
Avraham Avinu.
No.
What's the idea of Avraham?
If it's the authority of Avraham, then yeah. I mean, that's.
No, I'm saying like if a guy who doesn't believe in the Torah or the Bible,
right.
Whatever you want to call it,
right?
Is that something that he meaning by Avraham Avinu?
He's not going to be impressed by your story about Avraham Avinu.
No, but he.
But if Avraham Avinu made a rational argument that you see to be true, then that's fine. That's perfectly admissible. If it's a rational argument.
I'm taking the argument itself.
Yeah, the argument itself. Not the authority of Avraham. Right, correct. Okay. Okay.
Well, Avraham's conception of God was also based on science?
I mean, the Medrash has it that way. Yeah, it has it that way. In the Medrash Rabbah. He studied the world and he saw basically how could you have a. The castle and the lights around the castle, or the lighthouse, something like that. It's a very famous medrash. Largely fine, let's say fine tuning. What?
It's a very modern medrash?
What?
The lighthouse?
There were
yeah, yeah, they had lighthouses torches, back torches. Then. Something about lighthouses. Or cell phone tower, I forgot what it was. I remember how it was, exactly. Okay, but the answer to your question is.
That's intelligent by design?
I think it's largely a proof of design, if you look at that medrash.
I think, according to everyone,
Yichud Hashem, that's the next chapter, second chapter. We're going to get into one, okay? But the first one, okay, we'll get there. Don't worry. We get there. Okay. To answer your question, though, is what I'm trying to say is that as science develops, it replaces, it keeps going deeper. Ultimately, true reality is beyond our grasp, but we can build models that approximate it. And if every model we build, you always see that there is a need for something outside of that model to explain it. That in fact gives you encouragement that this is not that the universe is not self-explanatory. There's always going to be something that you're going to need outside the universe to explain it.
Yeah, but if we see that the trend of science exponentially is to fill those gaps of things which we can't understand. And what people, you know, put as pure God has been explained more and more by science, then it would suggest that it's premature at any point to fill in the gap with God.
Yeah, right. In part one, I believe part one, we talk about God of the gaps. Okay, so there's a flaw, logical fallacy of God of the gaps. This is not, if you're trying to prove God, I think, from biology and evolution and that kind of thing, I think you very easily fall prey to God of the gaps.
What's God of the gaps?
God of the gaps is basically any time there's a thing that science can't explain, you say, it must be. How do you explain that? It must be God did that. You know?
Cancer.
Yeah, you know, so... something like that. So, and that's a logical fallacy. It's no good because then, you know, as soon as science advances and explains it, they say, oh, I don't need God for that, but I need God for the next thing.
You're continuously shrinking God.
Right, you're removing his... where you need him. But this book is really it's based upon it's going to the foundations of everything. We're not proving God from gaps in the creation. It's in the world. We're trying to argue for God's existence from the cause of the fundamental the foundations of the world, the laws of physics, and the order of the Big Bang basically. Those are the two main sources: the laws and quantities, the qualitative laws and quantities of the laws of physics is the first main line of reasoning, and the second one is from the entropy, but the order of the order of the universe that began at the Big Bang. Okay, according to everyone,
you have all the laws of physics in the book in order to.
The laws of physics?
All the laws of physics.
There's only two.
Can I buy this book?
There's only two, okay? There's only two you have to know, okay? Quantum mechanics and general relativity, you don't really have to know that much about them, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Good, because I don't know anything about
it. Okay, good. You don't need to. Don't worry about it. Okay, good. So far, so good?
But yeah, it would be a good book. I mean...
All right.
It's there. Okay, good. Anything else? Or should we move on to...
good.
Okay, so let's start. Okay, so this is it. In part one, okay, we introduced the mystery of the constants and the discovery of fine-tuning. Okay, we argued that fine-tuning indicates that the values of the constants are the result of an intelligent fine-tuner. Okay, so in part one, we focus mostly on the constants, okay, the constants of nature, more so than the qualitative laws. Okay, what I mean by that is like this. You have, let's just stay in classical physics, okay? You guys know a little bit about electromagnetism, I'm assuming, right?
Nope.
Sure. You know the idea that an electron has a negative charge?
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Okay, so two electrons have the same charge, they repel each other. An electron and a proton have the opposite charges they attract?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. So, it happens to be, this is, you know, it goes by the square of their distance, so you don't know that.
No.
Doesn't matter. Okay, irrelevant. Okay. The further apart they are, the weaker the force between them is.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
That makes sense. It's intuitive. Okay, fine. It happens to be there's a force that works the opposite way, but okay. Not our point. Now, now that's a qualitative idea, okay, that opposite charges attract, and similar charges repel. Okay? Okay, that's a qualitative idea. Okay, but then there is a quantity. Okay, there's a quantity. How much do they repel each other? How much do they attract? Right, that's a quantitative question. The qualitative idea is the opposite charges attract and like charges repel each other. But then how much? How strong is that?
And that's the square of the distance.
That's not the square. That's a number. Okay, that's a number. That number is called the fine structure constant. Okay, which tells you the strength of the interaction between charges. Okay, it's the fine structure constant. It's written as alpha. It's a Greek letter, and that determines a certain quantity. Okay, so for example, two electrons, right, also have a mass. They each have a mass. So mass is gravity, and they always attract each other because they have the same masses. They have the same charges, so they repel, but they also attract themselves because they have the same mass. So far, so good? All mass attracts. Every mass is always attracted. Gravity.
Yeah.
Gravity always, everything attracts itself, right? Now the question is the attraction between two electrons because of the mass, right? What's the relationship, right? Is the repulsion because of their charges stronger or weaker than the attraction due to their masses? Okay, that should be enough. That right? Those facts are fairly simple, right? Okay, and what determines that relationship between their attraction because of their masses and the repulsion because of their charges is called the fine structure constant. Okay, and that tells you how strong it is. If it was, and it's a number, okay? It's just a number. It's a fundamental constant in nature. Okay, and the number is 1 over 137, approximately. Okay, but it's not just 137, it's 0.19075496, and it goes on. Okay?
Which one's stronger?
Electromagnetism is much stronger, and it's astonishingly stronger. It's 10 to the 40 times stronger.
So what does the number represent?
Okay, the number is determines how strong that interaction is. It's just a number. It has no units. It's a number. It's a dimension. It's called a dimensionless constant.
Do those decimals go on infinitely?
We don't know. The only we have no way of determining what this number is. The only way we know it is by measuring it. There's no theoretical. There's no theory that tells us what this number should be. You have to measure it.
Well, what do you mean? What does the number correlate to? What physical phenomena are we seeing?
The how strong the strength of repulsion between two electrons is.
When you take away how much. How the attraction was? Is it the proportion of
that? No, you don't need to do that. That's just a little easier way to do it, like a ratio. You need that's kind of makes the point clear. You don't need it. The number exists independently.
How does a number represent that strength? I mean, it's like the units that they move apart from each other per instant in time. Like, what does the number mean?
I mean, ultimately,
yeah.
It has to do with the probability that an electron and a photon will interact. It's a probability. And if when you get down to quantum mechanics, it's a probability. But that's beyond. We're going to get to that in a few chapters. But for right now, it's just to know that there's these part of what you're given. Okay, well, what we assume in the law, fundamental laws of nature, of quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanics has rules. You ever hear the Schrodinger equation?
No.
Nope.
No? Yes. Okay. You ever heard of Newton's three laws of motion?
Yes.
Okay, so Newton's three laws of motion. So in quantum mechanics, there's a Schrodinger equation. It's like a modern, more modern version of that. It's the law itself. And it's just not enough to have laws. Like, you have to have quantities. Because laws can tell you qualitatively how things work, but you need to know quantitatively. Okay, there's a gravitational constant, right? There's a bunch of the electron. How much mass does an electron have? Right? Every single electron has exact same amount of mass. Okay, every single proton has the same amount of mass, right? And every proton is 1,879 times bigger than an electron. Every single one. Okay, it's always the same. Okay, where do these numbers come from? Right, that's the problem. Where do the numbers come from? Where do the laws come from? That's one type of problem. Okay, but to some degree, whatever, these are the qualitative laws, but where do these numbers come from? There's about 25 of these numbers. Okay, they're called the constants of the standard model of particle physics, the basic quantum mechanics. There's also one that comes from general relativity called the cosmological constant, which determines the expansion of the universe. Okay, but they're just numbers. Okay, they're essentially just numbers, dimensionless constants. And dimensionless means it's not like grams over seconds. It's just a number.
But yes, it represents something. That's what you're talking about.
It's a number. It's a number that determines the strength.
How do you derive it then?
You don't derive it. You measure it.
Measure what? What do you measure? How?
You're measuring the strength. How much the electrons?
So doesn't the number represent the strength of whatever you're measuring?
Well, strength.
It determines the strength.
What is strength? If I said he's a 7 strength, that doesn't mean anything.
I'm an 18 strength.
You're right. You're going to be measuring the acceleration of how much and two electrons accelerate away from each other. That's what you're measuring. But what determines that is the fine structure constant. That's what determines it. Okay, listen. This is part one. No, you don't need it. You have to. What?
It doesn't matter where the electron is attached to.
Like, no, these are universal laws and universal constants.
Oxygen has electrons, right?
Mm-hmm. Oxygen has electrons, yeah.
And carbon has electrons.
Right. Yeah. All those electrons are the same. They're all every electron is the same as every other electron.
I think we need a list of things to do.
Okay, forget the fine structure constant. What about the mass? The mass makes sense, right? The mass of an electron, the mass of a proton, right? So if you make a ratio between those two.
That's the ratio.
That becomes a number. A ratio is just a pure number, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Let's stick with that. Okay? Much simpler. Okay, good? So what determines the mass of an electron? Why does every electron have this mass?
So every electron has the same mass?
Yes.
That's the question.
Yes, relative to every proton.
I assume the semi-universal law that dictates why electrons form, why other things form.
Right, that's the problem. There isn't.
Isn't that a circular question?
Why is that a circular question?
The electron defines the thing that has X mass. You just ask
correct.
Why
that's
it, why is it it?
Right, okay, so the question is it right? So that's one approach. One approach is to say, look, why does electron have the mass it does? It just does. You can't ask that question. Right. It just does.
You're saying, why do entities exist with this mass? I assume there's some universal law that dictates why electrons exist. No.
No.
Or is it we just don't know that?
Electrons are fundamental particles. Okay. There's a few fundamental particles in nature. They're not comprised. What they mean by fundamental means they're not made up of anything else. Right? It happens to be a proton is not fundamental. It's made up of quarks. Okay. But quarks and electrons are fundamental.
Electrons are not made up of quarks?
Well, electron is not made up of anything else. Electron is the fundamental particle as far as we know. It's not made up of anything else.
Did they find something recently?
No.
Is
that Higgs boson? That electron's made out of? No.
No, they found another...
A boson, Higgs boson?
Yeah, they found...
Okay, that's another fundamental particle.
Does an electron have one?
Okay, in the standard model, we treat it as a point particle. It's treated as a point particle with no extension. Okay?
It's
just a point. It's zero dimensional. But I don't want to get into it. It's a fun. It sounds right, but it's a fundamental particle. It's idea.
Scientists know what they're talking about. Like, do they know what's going on?
It's a fundamental. Look, think about it. Is everything? Look, you're going to say, what is your body made out of? It's made up of organs. What's the organs made up of?
Molecules. Geometry,
like a point. Well, a point.
What are the three things there? A point, a line.
A point. A point has zero dimensions.
Yeah, so it's like a
fundamental. A point particle. Yeah. It's points. It's a point. It's points.
There's something to points, there's a line, there's like three things, right?
Plane?
In three.
Plane. So you're saying the same type of thing. You're saying the same type of thing exists in physics?
Yeah. There's points. It's treated. It's treated as a point. It's treated as a point.
It's not really a point, but we pretend like it is.
You know, this is the problem with fundamental. Okay, when you're dealing with fundamentals, okay, you can't explain something fundamental in terms of anything else. That's, or it wouldn't be fundamental. Okay.
No, I'm not asking that it's completely similar. My question is more: if electrons and the fundamental particles are all zero dimensional, how could they combine to form multidimensional structures?
Oh, because they're separated in space from each other. Mm-hmm. Multiple electrons are going around the proton. But yeah, you don't push electrons together and make like electrons never really touch each other.
If you could.
So when do you get something?
Right. That's not how you make things. No.
When do you get something?
You get like a table is 99% empty space.
And 1%.
You know, it's 99.99.
Would it be 100% empty space?
No, yeah. Because there's don't let the 0% the zero dimensional thing. Get in your way, because the way when you touch a table, because when you touch a table, you don't actually touch an electron. That's not what happens. When you jump, a guy jumps off a building and he hits the floor and he goes splat. He never actually makes contact with the ground. It's just the electrons on the concrete arrange themselves in a way that they create an electric force such that he goes splat. But you never actually touch it.
Oh, I understand, but.
Okay, so you don't have to. The reason you can't go through the table is not because you hit electrons.
No, I know, but assuming the table has width, 0% of this width is comprised by electrons.
The width is because there's one electron over here, and there's one electron on the other side over there, and that's what bounds the table.
We're saying they bound space, but they don't produce anything themselves.
Right. Correct.
So this is just a charge, which gives off like a, which bounces light to make it look brown, and gives a certain charge which makes it feel like this. But all physical things are not actually anything.
Basically, everything you interact with the world, almost everything except for gravity, is going to be electrons and light, more or less.
It's just charges.
It's all charges, well, yeah. You're touching the table, it's because there's a force. Because two electrons repel each other, and the closer you get to this table, the stronger the force between electrons in your hand and electrons in the table get.
That's so interesting.
Okay, so that's all true. That's why you can't. That's why you feel a force when you hit the table. You're not actually hitting the table.
That's the repulsion.
That's so cool.
Okay. That's the repulsion, right, correct. Okay, good. Okay. So I got that out of the way.
It's all kinetic motion.
That's not in part one. What?
Is all of the kinetic motion due to electromagnetism then?
Kinetic motion.
Yeah, kinetic physics.
No, not necessarily.
No. I mean like this stuff.
When you hit a table, that's what's going on. That's electromagnetism. That's the force you're most familiar with. That and, I guess, gravity. Okay? Yeah. Almost everything. You see, as the electromagnetic force. Okay. This is the problem. Okay, is scientists would be very happy. Okay, if they found one qualitative law of nature, a theory of everything, which would explain the entire universe. Okay, you see many things in the universe. You see planets. You see stars. You have oceans and molecules, lots of different things, and they ultimately try to find laws which unify those phenomena and simplify them and explain those phenomena. That is the pursuit of science, trying to find simple, unified explanations which make sense of the various, diverse observations that we see. Okay? Yeah.
Sorry, how many fundamental particles or whatever are there?
Like that?
No.
A handful.
It's constants.
No, 20 or so. Oh, the constants? There's like 25.
No, not the constants. The
particles?
Like electron.
Yeah, there's different families. There's like 6, probably 18. There's like 6 times 3 or something like that. Mm. Something like there's that. Maybe 4, I don't know, 4. It's like
4 and they're grouped and they have
you like look it up. It's like 12, 18, 15, 16,
and
20.
They have like different properties, which can be...
Yeah, different properties, correct. Different properties, different masses. Okay?
Andrew, can you just... I forgot. Can you define a constant one more time?
A constant is a number, which determines something about... They do different things. One constant determines how fast the universe expands.
So there are different constants.
Right. One constant determines the mass of an electron. Another constant determines the strength of the interaction. Basically, you have laws of nature, and then you have... But laws of nature, they're mathematical,
right.
And they have quantities.
Right.
Okay. Now, what determines the quantities is numbers.
Right.
And don't understand that those constants are fundamental.
Right, they're called the fundamental constant nature because they can't be explained by anything else as far as we know. Mm-hmm. Again, there's about 25 of them, and they're not like nice numbers like 2 or pi or e or, you know, 7. They're like crazy numbers, okay? Like, you know, a 0.0 with 40 zeros and then 1, or, you know, like one. Like I said, 137 point something, something, something. Yeah. They're not good numbers. They're arbitrary, wild-looking numbers that have no rhyme and reason. Okay?
I mean, would 10 be a good number or a bad number?
10's a beautiful number.
Is that just a kind of base 10 system?
It's a minimum.
It's still compared to these numbers, oh, if they had 10, what would they do for 10? Okay? It's a nice, round, whole, it's
saying,
an integer. You're
saying nice are just a reflection of our counting system?
Yeah, but even 6 or 52 would be nice. It's a whole, it's an integer. You know what I mean? You can make it
Wouldn't that suggest God more than a totally random constant? In other words, if we had constants which were like, you know, beautiful numbers.
No, we're not up to God yet. We're not up to God yet. We're just up to how you explain a number.
Yeah, but isn't integer just a relative thing? Meaning, what if we said that...
No, integer is not. Integer is not a relative thing.
Right, but let's say we said whatever digit that these numbers are, and we said one of those in our new counting system is worth 1. Wouldn't that make a 1, and then everything else is
counter
relative to that?
Even if you wanted to define a decimal, one of these crazy decimals, you still got 24 other ones. It's not going to work. They're not reducible to each other. There's 25 of these wacky numbers.
Hmm. Are any of them related to each other?
No, I don't think so. But I mean, look, in theory, maybe some of them you could try to relate and bring it down to 18. But ultimately, you have these numbers, okay, and you have quantities. And this is the problem. This is the problem of physics. Okay, it was Feynman called it the. Here, let me read you, so you don't think I went out. Let's see from part one. Okay, I'll bring you. Hopefully, it's here. Okay, this is the mystery. I'm not getting. There's no God at this point. Okay, let's see.
It's all part one so far.
Yeah, it was part one. We're not going to finish the introduction tonight.
Come back. How long is part one?
You're welcome to come back.
Part one is longer than part three.
What?
Okay, so here's the quote. Okay, so this is Richard Feynman in QED. It's a marvelous book. You should all read it. Okay. QED? QED, yes. Quantum Electrodynamics. Okay. Marvelous book, okay? Special book. Okay, he did this. He writes this on page 129. He writes, there's a most profound and simple question associated with the observed coupling constant. Okay, the coupling constant is the fine structure constant I was talking about before. The coupling between an electron and light. Is a simple number that has been experimentally determined to be close to 0.0854245. My physicist friends won't recognize this number because they like to remember it as the inverse of its square, about 137.03597. Okay, nowadays we know a little bit more precisely. With about an uncertainty of about 2 in the last decimal place. It's been a mystery ever since it was discovered more than 50 years ago. Right? This is written in 1985. Right, so it's even longer. It's about 80 years now. And all good theoretical physicists put this number up on their wall and worry about it. Immediately, you would like to know where this number for coupling comes from. Is it related to pi or perhaps to the base of natural logarithms? That's e. Nobody knows. It's one of the greatest damn mysteries of physics. A magic number that comes to us with no understanding by man. You might say the hand of God wrote the number, and we don't know how he pushed his pencil. We know what kind of dance to do experimentally to measure this number very accurately. We don't know what kind of dance to do on the computer to make this number come out without putting it in secretly. Okay? That is the mystery of the constants, eloquently said by Feynman. Yeah, go ahead.
Why would e or pi be any better?
Because those are mathematical constants. Those are, like, e pi is related to the circumference, ratio of a circumference of a circle to its radius.
Why would that determine the relationship between electrons and light?
No, because then you could say maybe there's some geometric reason behind why when an electron interacts with light, maybe there's something to do with circles.
Isn't that an early number to describe a circle, though?
Pi?
Doesn't it just push the question to something else?
No, but the mathematical constants are special. They're purely based upon logic or mathematics without any type of... They emerge from mathematics, pure mathematics.
Why
are those true?
Those aren't based on any physics. Those are true in any, like, pi is like an objective truth about mathematics, geometry.
It's a valid question to ask, where did this number in physics come from? And I can't answer. That's just the nature of physics.
Well, if you could tie it to a mathematical constant, it would give you a strong approach to a solution. It wouldn't be the end solution, but it would give you a good approach.
But forget about that. Just focusing on the sign. Do they have the same question? Do mathematicians have the same question on pi?
No.
Why not? It's a constant.
I mean, why is it that number and not some other number?
It's an ugly number for a constant.
Terrible. It's infinitely bad. It gets worse and worse.
Where do the transcendental numbers come from?
They're called
the transcendental numbers.
But can't I ask even this, like, without getting into this, like...
I don't know. That's a good question.
Crazy
I'm not sure.
Science. Can't I even ask this, Tom? Like, you know, why do all, you know, why do trees grow a certain way?
Well, we have a reason for that. There's a reason. It's botany. There's an explanation for why trees grow. That's not
so. You have to get down to some fundamental, and then the fundamental you just ask why.
I mean, that's what science does. Science explains why trees grow.
Right. The fundamental has to be some random axiomatic thing.
There is going to be some axiomatic thing. Now they would like that axiomatic thing to be nice and beautiful and simple.
I guess my question is, what do you mean we would like? Meaning, presumably, just statistically speaking, there's no reason the axiomatic number should be more any one number than any other number in the books, right?
Right.
So is it indicative of a question if there?
Well, how do you explain it? How do you explain a number?
I explain it somehow, they just have to be.
Okay, so that's one explanation. Is these 25 numbers just have to be? They necessarily exist.
That is just what it is.
Right. That's one explanation. Now, nobody likes that because that's not what science, as we pursue scientifically, the explanation of the world, things get simpler and more unified and more beautiful. Okay, and just to say that at the end of the day, we arrive at 25 arbitrary numbers as the root of all existence, and they happen to be that number. It's possible. There's nothing illogical about that theory. It's just certainly not a beautiful theory. Okay, and we would like to find a deeper explanation.
Agreed, but do we think that a beautiful number, underlying number, is more probable, or we just would like...
Well, hold off a second. Okay, you can see intuitively why it's not so beautiful. You don't want to say that. You'd like for a deeper explanation.
Yeah, it would be nice if the underlying root of the universe is 1 plus 1 equals 2 or something like that.
That would be much nicer, correct?
Yeah, nice.
But it's not. That's the problem. Yeah, go ahead.
But who cares? As a number?
Well, this is part one. Go ahead.
Who cares if the number is nicer or not? The question is still the same. Are you trying to make a distinction between a nice round number versus a crazy number, or like meaning?
Yeah, there is a distinction.
A fundamental question, like if there's a fundamental.
Yeah. Number, if there's any number, what explains the number? Yeah. Correct. Forget the multiverse. Okay. I just want to say one thing. Okay. In general, I'm perfectly willing. These are great questions. It's exactly what you should be asking. I want to go through this. I just want to do this in part three.
Okay.
If we were doing part one, totally. Exactly what we should be doing. It's just, we're not doing part one right now. I'm just giving you an overview so you just kind of know enough background that you'll know, be able to do part three.
Okay.
But absolutely, these are the right questions, okay? And this is definitely the most abstract part of part one, is this point. Okay, so it is the mystery, and then taking for my word, it's a mystery, okay? And Feynman says it too, trust him, okay? Okay, that's the problem. How do you explain the numbers? They're very hard, these constants. Okay, what happened was, at some point, scientists discovered this thing called fine-tuning, okay? Which turned out that these numbers are not arbitrary, random 25 numbers, but it comes out that if you change these numbers a little bit, 1% this way, 1% that way, 4% this way, things like that, the universe doesn't work. Okay? You change the fine structure constant a little bit, make it a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller, like maybe, 139 or 134 or whatever it is, you don't get atoms anymore. Electrons don't bind with protons, you don't have any atoms. Okay? Or you don't get any stars. Okay? If you don't have any stars, you can't get, you don't get galaxies, you don't get planets, you don't get any elements more than hydrogen and helium. From the Big Bang, you just get hydrogen and helium, essentially. All the heavier elements are made inside of stars. You need stars.
I know it's part one, but what makes things work or not work? Like, why is it a working universe? Just different types of universes?
Well, you could have a universe of just a bunch of fundamental particles running around, bouncing into each other. Okay, but then you could have a universe with atoms and molecules and planets and stars and trees, right, and galaxies and all these amazing things that you see in the universe. Or you can have a universe with just a bunch of electrons and protons running around for all eternity. Okay, you have to, in a certain sense, intuitively be able to see that those are two different, and there's something special about the fact that we have this universe with all this different structure and complex structures and all different orders of magnitude. I mean, it's amazing. And those, it's, don't take it for granted that if I have gravity and quantum mechanics, I'm going to get all these things. I'm going to get planets and atoms and molecules and things like that. It's not true. Just if you have the qualitative laws of nature, but the quantities are off by even a little, okay, you end up with having nothing. Okay? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I think you just answered it, but do you get something else? Or you
no, you get nothing. Basically, you get...
You get mush?
You get mush, exactly. You get total, random, chaotic...
When you change one constant without changing the others?
Correct. Just changing one constant. Correct. Right. And if you change all of them, everything goes down. Now, is it possible if you change all of them in specifically a certain way that maybe you can get something else that works? Maybe, but it doesn't matter. Then it has to be two perfect arrangements. But essentially, in almost every other way you do it, you change these constants, you know, and the possibilities for what's the possibility that what could it have been? By theory alone, what could a 137 have been?
What if you said that there's...
Anything. I mean, it could have been anything. It's just a number. So what are the odds that it's... Right, that's the question. How do you get this number?
Yeah, it's not theoretically possible to say that there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of options of proportionate manipulation of all the constants, which would create...
I mean, look, all the ones that, like, we can see don't work. Okay. Right, correct. Correct. And, you know, maybe this one guy wants to argue there's, like, another particular one you could still get a star. Okay, fine. But, like, one other one. But whatever.
You could probably have proportional combinations or even try it.
In theory, correct, but like you, we know, but like something you could just see the cosmological constant that if it's like too big, everything just the universe expands too quickly before you get any galaxies. You know what I mean? You could change everything else you want, but if the universe just expands so quickly, then every particle becomes isolated from everything else.
Unless they move quicker, also proportionately.
No, I mean space can expand faster than the speed of light, and that's the end of the game. The game's over.
Like one of those constants.
The speed of light, not really. I don't think. I think it's a combination of the speed of light with other things.
Plus whatever those are, I'm just saying.
Yeah, but maybe. But there's still an infinite... The amount of possible ways that could go wrong grossly outweighs the amount of ways that it would go right. Okay? Okay, and this is Les Mondopolic. One guy staying. Okay? Nobody really argues. Okay? There's nobody really argues. Basically, everybody understands this point. Okay, that was the discovery of fine-tuning. And the question is, so how exactly did these numbers get to be the way they are? Okay, so, yeah? Okay, good. That's the question. Okay, these numbers, you would like to explain them. They're fundamental constants of nature. How did they get to be the way they are? But then we discovered fine-tuning. We realized these are not random, arbitrary numbers, but these are the exact numbers that they have to be this particular value in order to get a universe with all this amazing stuff that we have. Okay, we argued in part one that when you see something which has a purpose... Okay, meaning that the purpose of the constants, the particular values of the constants, is to get a universe with atoms and molecules and planets and stars and life and everything else. So that shows you that the cause of the constants is intelligent. Okay, because that's what intelligence is. Intelligence is something that operates with a purpose. It chooses particular numbers for a certain purpose. So the cause of the constants chose those values in order to make a universe with all this amazing stuff that we have in it. Okay, that was the essential line of reasoning of part one. Okay, I'm leaving out entropy for now. Yeah, do you have a question? Go ahead. No? Nobody's question?
Just about entropy?
What?
Just wanted to ask you about entropy.
Yeah, good one. Okay, we should leave this for at least now. Okay, now, oh boy, 956, so we'll do multiverse next week. Yeah, go ahead.
Are we the Marvin?
Pretty much. We can make everything. I'm going to sleep. You can go to sleep.
No.
Okay, just in terms of intelligence, it wasn't Tavian. We're defining intelligence as like something which operates with a purpose, a final cause. Okay, it has a purpose. So we're saying that the cause that selected the constants for the purpose of making the universe, the cause of the constants is intelligent. But the constants themselves are not intelligent. They're just doing their job.
Based on that definition, why... Can you say that the line?
Okay, so your question: the computer programmer, the one who programmed the computer, is intelligent because he made the computer for a certain purpose to make certain calculations in order to be able to, you know, decide how much to pay on his taxes. But the computer is not intelligent; it's just following the rules that
so
you put into.
So
it.
What's the definition of intelligence again?
Intelligence is something that you selecting out something for a purpose.
So if the computer selects something for a purpose.
It's not you're selecting it. You just program the computer to follow a set of rules. It looks like the computer is doing it. Ultimately, the programmer is the one behind it.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't that just adding a consciousness to...
Not consciousness. The programmer program. It's like, look, when you hit take a hammer and you hit the nail, the hammer didn't hit the nail. You did through the tool of the hammer. Okay, so you're using a computer to do something. The computer's not intelligent. You're intelligent using a computer as a tool. It's just following a set of an algorithmic process, a totally formal set of rules.
But if the thing is...
If one thing is off, the computer can't correct it. It's called a bug, you know.
If the thing's nature is to produce something and it doesn't have any conscious awareness of it, or...
Not conscious. Nothing in consciousness.
If a tree's nature is to grow upwards, and I can see that all trees grow upwards, I wouldn't say a tree's intelligent from it. That's just...
Right, that's not why it's doing it. It's just following its nature.
Right, so why can't I just say that the cause of the universe is following its nature to create a
tree? Oh, I don't know. Fine. But, okay, good. Maybe. Right, you're saying whatever... But whatever. Oh, you mean maybe there's something... Okay, we'll get to that.
Behind it. I'm just saying it could either be its intelligent, meaning in an active way where it possesses some awareness of a goal, or maybe it's its nature to produce its outcome.
Okay, well, we'll take this up. Let's take this up next week. Good, Marv. Okay.